This is the takeaway for Monday, November 6, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
The people who ran, did Sunday schools, the people who did the Thursday night meals, the people who played the music, any type of act that they were doing in the church, there was somebody lost in almost every aspect.
Sutherland Springs, Texas. We will now add this tiny town, almost an hour east of San Antonio, to the long list of places across the country, large and small, that we now recognize by name as the site of a shooting massacre. The details in Sutherland Springs are horrifyingly familiar. Around 11:30 on Sunday morning, a lone gunman, dressed in all black, carrying a semi-automatic AR-15-style rifle, walked into the tiny First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs. About 60 congregants were gathered inside for Sunday services. The gunman opened fire. 26 people were killed, including children and a pregnant woman. The victims, as old as 77, as young as 18 months old. At least 20 people were wounded. Officials have identified the suspect as Devin Kelly, a 26-year-old white man from nearby Comal County. He was found dead by a gunshot wound in a neighboring county after fleeing the scene in a car. Officials have not discussed any apparent racial or political motive. Lauren McGaughey is the state politics reporter for the Dallas Morning News. She's in Sutherland Springs. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Lauren, I mentioned that the victims range from 77 years old down to an 18-month-old child, and we heard from one of the people in the town at the top that these killings included people with roles in every aspect of life, both in the town and in the church. Do we have a better sense of who the victims were?
We're starting to. There haven't been a lot of official confirmations of who these victims are, but I spent the day yesterday with the Ward family. Just happened to walk up to them when they were standing outside of their home, which is about two blocks from the church. And they were waiting on news from four family members who were inside the church for morning services. I met up with them at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And by about 11 o'clock at night, they had found out that three of their family members had died. This did include a five-year-old girl named Brooke Ward, and a seven-year-old girl named Emily Garza. These were cousins, nieces, and nephews of the Ward family. And the mother of those two children was also dead. So, I mean, there's stories of one family that lost someone from three generations, possibly up to eight members of that family. That's the Holcomb family. And when I was speaking to members of the community yesterday, just standing on the street, they said, you know, this community, you know the families, you know the Holcombs, you know the Wards. You, when you're in the church, when you're outside of the church, everyone knows each other. It's only about 600 people, a little bit north of 600 people live in this community. So if 26 died, you can imagine that's, you know, almost 4 or 5% of the people that live in town. So absolutely everyone has been touched by this in a very intimate way. And it's just terrible to see it unfold and to see people waiting on news and unfortunately, more often than not, getting bad news.
Lauren, the suspect here, a 26-year-old man, Devin Kelly, what do we know about him? We're hearing reports that his in-laws may have attended this very church.
That's right, Todd. The reports are that the sheriff confirmed that Devin Kelly's in-laws did attend First Baptist Church. They were not there. That is the reports that we're hearing now. But that would obviously make a very direct link between this young man and the church that he allegedly shot at. What we know about him as well is obviously he was very young. He had been in the military, in the Air Force. He received a bad conduct mischarge, actually, in I believe it was 2014, stemming from issues with domestic violence. He lived in New Braunfels, as far as we know, which is a bit of a drive from here. You know, it's not right down the street. It's a suburb of San Antonio, which is a good 20, 30 miles away. And obviously, we've been trying to reach out to his family, to his wife. He has a young wife and a handful of young children. We've been trying to locate them to ensure their safety, which so far we have been unable to do.
Lauren, the suspect, Devin Kelly, is dead. I want to ask you about the circumstances of that, but here's some sound from local resident Johnny Langendorf, who pursued the suspect after the shooting.
I pulled up to the intersection where the shooting happened, and I saw two men exchanging gunfire, the other being a citizen of the community. And the shooter of the church had taken off, fled in his vehicle, and the other gentleman came and he said we needed to pursue him, that he just shot up the church. And so that's what I did. I just acted and got him off the road. And
okay.
That sound courtesy of KSAT Television Channel 12. Lauren, that citizen is describing pursuing the suspect in his car, a chase that went to the next county.
Yeah. So Johnny Langendorf and another individual who we haven't actually been able to identify at this time did pursue Devin Kelly. It sounds like a pretty harrowing chase. At one point, they said they were going about 95 miles an hour down Highway 87. Mr. Kelly did crash, and when the police found him in the car, he was dead. So it's unclear whether one of these members of town, one of the individuals, actually shot Kelly, and then Kelly got into his car and drove and crashed, or whether the fatal wound to Kelly was self-inflicted. At this point, we're kind of waiting for that information. But Mr. Kelly is dead at this time, and so that, you know, obviously closes up the opportunity to understand more immediately why he did this and what his motives were.
Lauren McGaughey, Dallas Morning News. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
As a state, we are dealing with the largest mass shooting in our state's history. There's so many families who've lost family members, fathers, mothers, sons, and daughters. The tragedy, of course, is worsened by the fact that it occurred in a church, a place of worship, where these people were innocently gunned down.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott there. Details on the tragic shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas, continue to emerge. As law enforcement and citizens and observers continue to try to piece together this tragedy, Fred Burton is a national security analyst and vice president of intelligence with the intelligence firm Stratfor, based in Austin, Texas. Fred Burton, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
Fred, how do you begin to interpret a shooting like this on a vulnerable population in a church on a Sunday?
Well, when you look at this kind of attack, and it unfolded yesterday when I was driving back from College Station, Texas, back to Austin, you pass several churches just like this one. So when you look at this from a soft target perspective, you have to keep that in mind and recognize fully that it's impossible for law enforcement authorities to be able to protect all of them. So it boils down to each and every church, to include the little ones like this one, to have a plan in place, and also to think about having some off-duty deputies there or attending the congregation.
Fred, you are talking about a term that people like you use all the time, situational awareness. People aren't used to having situational awareness in a town of 600 when they go to church on a Sunday.
No, they're not, Todd. But in essence, this is the new norm in America. You can look at the entertainment venue in Las Vegas as an example of the unexpected. The vehicle ramming attack in New York City is things that, as you move away from the East Coast, folks kind of expect those things to occur in big cities. But you don't expect these kinds of events to occur in these small little churches. But it's the kind of shift, Todd, that we really need to start thinking about as a nation. And literally, the citizens need to think about how they would respond to an event like this if it unfolded in front of them.
What will authorities be thinking about now as they try to piece together motive, background of the suspect, whether he had personal grievances or political or a mixture of both?
Well, there will always be motive, Todd. In every investigation or attack that I've ever looked into, there's always motive. So there will be motive here. Now, it might not make sense to you and I, but he had a very specific reason for targeting that church. On a practical level, I would want to be looking at the attack cycle. For example, when did he start planning this attack? Did he message this to anybody close to him, whether that be his wife or other family members or friends? The other interesting aspect is he appeared to work as a security officer at a large water park, which is pretty close to Austin, Texas, in between Austin and San Antonio. So the investigators will be pulling his employment records and in essence, reconstructing his entire life.
Texas is a place, of course, where gun rights are a closely guarded part of the culture. That's no surprise. Yet again, we have a semi-automatic AR-15, apparently, as the weapon of choice here. Is that important to investigators, or is that more important as people piece together the aftermath?
It will be factored into the investigation. It's my understanding it was a Ruger AR-556, probably of the semi-automatic variant, which you can buy anywhere in Texas on any given day. I thought it was amazing, the citizen response, the neighbor that saw this unfold and actually went and got his gun and started shooting at the bad guy. Which resulted in the suspect dropping the weapon and fleeing, and then a couple other folks chasing after him. So it's really an amazing story, something out of the Wild Wild West.
So Fred Burton, as people begin to piece together the potential motives of the shooter, it does inevitably remind us of Las Vegas just a little over a month ago, where investigators there apparently have come up with very few, if any, details about the motivation and planning of the shooter there.
It is. It's fascinating that in the Las Vegas case, during the autopsy, they shipped the brain off to Stanford for further examination, which tells me they're looking at some degree of pathology. In this case, if I was part of this investigation, I would be wanting to know from a blood alcohol content and toxicology. You want to look at that to see what kind of meds perhaps this shooter was on to kind of factor into the equation too. As bad as these things are, Todd, there's a lot of lessons learned for law enforcement after each and every one of these events, to include how better to protect locations such as this.
And Fred, let's end it there, because you began by talking about soft targets across this country. Even if this disturbing need for situational awareness is required in places like tiny churches, there are tens of thousands of them across this country. Getting a security guard for each one just isn't going to be possible.
No, it's not. But it's certainly very possible for those attending these kinds of events to be prepared, think about what they would do to protect themselves and their family. To be blunt, it's incumbent upon the host, the venue, the location, your workplace, to have a plan and to train.
A new normal in America, says Fred Burton, Vice President of Intelligence with Stratfor. Fred, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Hi, this is Pete from New Jersey. The NRA propaganda campaign has convinced many Americans of a lie. The lie that the Second Amendment is unlimited. No right is unlimited. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater, then hide behind the First Amendment. Yesterday, it was a crowded church. A killer took an AR-15 to.
My name is Isabel. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I appreciated the interview with Fred Burton, but I'm confused about why citizens reacting to gun violence by protecting themselves has to be the only new norm in America. It seems like there are other solutions. Situational awareness might be one, but stricter gun laws are another. I think that could be another new norm for us.
Your voice in reaction to the shooting and the massacre in Sutherland Springs, Texas. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a message on our Facebook page or reach us on Twitter.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com. LegalZoom.com, providing legal answers to the day-to-day questions of small business owners through its network of independent attorneys, available nationwide. More information at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
Thanks for being with us today. It's Todd Zwillick. Let's go to Saudi Arabia now, where a surprising sweep over the weekend ended in the arrest of one of the world's richest men and several members of the Saudi royal family. Billionaire investor Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal owns major stakes in companies like Citigroup and Twitter. He was arrested along with nearly a dozen Saudi princes and several current and former ministers. Meanwhile, one Saudi prince died when his helicopter crashed near the border with Yemen, but the kingdom's state-owned media calls that an unrelated event. The newly appointed crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, son of the king, ordered these arrests as part of what he's calling a crackdown on corruption. Still, the government has not announced any formal charges here. Jared Kushner, the White House senior advisor and son-in-law of President Trump, has just ended a series of high-level meetings with the Saudis. David Kirkpatrick is an international correspondent with the New York Times based in Cairo. David, thanks for coming back.
It's my pleasure.
What do we know about these arrests in Saudi Arabia right now?
We don't know as much as we'd like. The state-owned Al Arabiya News Network has said there were 11 princes arrested, many former top ministers. I think a total of 38 people, in addition to the princes, were arrested. There are reports out of Saudi Arabia this morning on Monday of further arrests. Those who have been detained have apparently all been housed inside the Ritz-Carlton Riyadh, which has been turned into a kind of super high-end prison with the phones and the internet shut off.
So that's medium security, maximum luxury prison.
Yeah, I would say that's a good way to put it. The most important figure here who's been arrested is Prince bin Tayyib bin Abdulaziz. He was the head of the National Guard, which was the last one of the three main Saudi security services, which was not yet under the effective control of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Mohammed bin Salman has, with this blitz of arrests, not only cowed the business elite, but he has established full control over all of the armed forces of Saudi Arabia. And that gives him a really unique degree of control over the real power inside the kingdom that we haven't seen since its sort of modern founding in 1932.
So what you're suggesting then, David, is a pattern that maybe less fits the claim of an anti-corruption sweep and more one that fits the political motives of the crown prince and his desire to focus power on himself in the kingdom.
Well, for sure, he has targeted some people who have a kind of stink of corruption around them. But he certainly has not targeted everybody in Saudi Arabia who's got the stink of corruption around them. That it would be a long job and it would go on forever. He's also targeted rival powers within the kingdom. And when you're thinking about policing corruption, you're thinking about enforcing the rule of law. You envision openness, public trials, evidence. You know, that kind of thing. That's not this. This is more eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I'm going to grab some people in the middle of the night with no due process whatsoever, which is not what we in the West expect when we think of sort of clean government reforms.
And one of the other people that got caught by the toe in this game, David, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, one of the richest men in the world, billionaire investor from Saudi Arabia, a powerful financial force in his own right. And I think a lot of people were surprised that he was swept up.
Yes, because he is both rich and internationally visible and also apolitical. So he's not an obvious target. You know, there's a lot of reports of Saudi businessmen thinking of moving their money out of the kingdom because they were nervous about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reforms. The kingdom's economy has been shrinking. It's been implementing austerity measures to try to adjust to the low oil price. And the gambit is that over time, this kind of shrinkage in the public sector will be made up for by attracting foreign investment. We don't know when that's going to happen or how it's going to work. These moves are probably not going to help with that. All in all, it's left private investors a little shaky and eager to take their money out of the country where it might be safer. There's some speculation that Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, the richest man in Saudi Arabia and one of the richest men in the world, was also making those kinds of moves. So there may be an element of this which is about trying to use brute force to prevent capital flight.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about how foreign investors may be interpreting this, because Mohammed bin Salman has been one of the prime drivers behind moves in Saudi Arabia, as we understand it, to liberalize the economy a bit, get it away from dependence on oil, try to attract new and different types of investors to the kingdom. But you're saying, David, that this is going to spook a lot of those foreign investors and make them maybe not want to put their money in.
Yeah, I think that's, in the short term, that's certainly the case. I mean, supporters of Mohammed bin Salman and someone with as much money as him will always have some supporters, will say, look, in the long run, this is good because there's one man who controls the whole kingdom and no one can get in his way. And so his actions will be predictable and investors will like that. Maybe, but that's down the road. In the short run, this feels arbitrary. There's no transparency. It's not the rule of law. And I think there's little doubt that right now it has mostly spooked investors rather than attracted them.
The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has also been behind other policies in Saudi Arabia, really is the right hand of the king here. Escalation of the war with Yemen, the conflict with Qatar over the summer that we covered, and all of the consternation that caused the United States and the State Department. The overall strategy here, David, is it clear?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's clear that he's a man in a hurry. It's clear that he does not like Iran and its influence. And it's clear that he's laid out a vision of Saudi Arabia that looks like a giant United Arab Emirates. Not much progress in the way of political freedom, but more sort of modernity in social mores and private enterprise. But to get there, you know, he's picking fights with everybody. He's squaring off against the business elite in Saudi Arabia, which is accustomed to a lot of state spending and largesse or even corruption. He's squaring off against the religious police and the conservative religious establishment inside the kingdom. He's taking on Iranian proxies in Yemen, or people, the Houthis, who he believes are Iranian proxies. So he's got a lot of fights going in every direction at once. And that lends a certain incoherence to it. Certainly, it's not the way Saudi Arabia has behaved in the past. It was a staid kingdom, as we often report.
David Kirkpatrick, international correspondent with the New York Times. David, good to have you back.
It's a pleasure.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. President Trump is in Tokyo today, near the start of a 12-day, five-country swing across Asia. The president heads to South Korea on Tuesday, then China, then Vietnam, and then the Philippines at the end of the trip. Now, there's a lot at stake here for the United States. Already, the president has urged Japan to build more cars in the United States. He'll also discuss trade with South Korea and China. But it's North Korea and security that hangs over much of this presidential trip.
No one, no dictator, no regime, and no nation should underestimate ever American resolve. Every once in a while in the past, they underestimated us. It was not pleasant for them, was it?
Let's get right to it with Catherine Moon, political science professor at Wellesley College and Asia expert, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Hello.
There are five countries and a lot of different agendas on this trip, but as I mentioned, it seems like how to resolve the crisis with North Korea has to be sort of in the background of all these discussions.
In order to get cooperation on North Korea, he has to deal with his own agenda of America First, demanding that these Asian countries give the U.S. a better deal in terms of trade and access to investments, et cetera. In his speeches, he has made these statements. He actually distinguished the North Korean people from the regime by saying in public, quote, North Koreans are good people living under a bad regime.
Catherine, that sounds like the opening bid of a negotiation.
Well, we'll see, because as you know, in the past, when some of his deputies have made the actual policy orientation of trying to get dialogue with the North, when they've made that clear, he just turned around and slapped them via Twitter. So I don't know how long these positions might last. They could just be for show. I don't know how sincere they are and how much weight they'll have in terms of actual strategy with North Korea.
What has been the effect of the United States pulling back from international agreements like the Paris Climate Accords, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as the president goes to these leaders and says the United States still wants to do business?
I think the East Asian countries are trying to figure out how to work without the U.S., frankly. There are indicators that Japan and India may be considering an alliance, and that would certainly be one positioned against China. At the same time, Japan and China have been warming up to one another. China and South Korea very recently, right before the departure of Trump on his Asia tour actually reconciled on this very thorny issue of THAAD, the U.S. anti-missile defense system that China has been really, really adamantly opposed to. So these Asians are looking out for their own interests to shore up their security and their economic positions.
The president is going to end this trip in the Philippines, meeting with the president there, Rodrigo Duterte. We have covered extensively on this show the extrajudicial crackdowns on drug users, drug dealers, the drug war in the Philippines. What message does it send to the world that the president of the United States is ending his trip in Manila?
He's going to end the trip in the Philippines that is headed by a thug, frankly, who has deliberately fawned admiration for Mr. Trump, and it's been requited. Mr. Trump has saluted Mr. Duterte. So it's not surprising that he's ending on what he hopes to be a high note in the Philippines, which means that he really does not care about the extrajudicial killings. The Philippines, I don't even know if Mr. Trump knows, frankly, how hard the Filipinas and Filipinos have fought for democracy and human rights in their country.
Catherine Moon, political science professor at Wellesley College, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Voters head to the polls in many communities across America tomorrow, and voters in New York State have a special kind of democratic ritual when they go to vote on Tuesday. Every 20 years, New Yorkers vote to decide whether the state should hold a constitutional convention and open up the state's constitution to changes. The legislature has moved to amend the constitution before in New York, but citizens, though they get this shot every 20 years, they haven't done it since 1938. Fred Mogul is a state government and politics reporter for WNYC who's been covering the debate over the New York Con-Con, as it's called. Fred, Con-Con is the constitutional convention.
It is, although we try to minimize that jargon. It makes us want to break into song like the Can-Can.
It's true. All right, we'll avoid it as much as we can. I can't promise that we won't hit it one more time before we're done. But the fact that I mentioned there, Fred, is surprising that voters in New York get this option every 20 years to open up the Constitution, but they rarely take it.
Well, it's always on a low turnout year. It's an odd year. There's almost no state races on the ballot. Unlike New Jersey and Virginia, we don't have a gubernatorial contest. We have local contests, but they're mostly decided in the primary. So very, very low turnout is one factor. The other is that the people against it perennially have been stronger and louder than those who have been for it. Usually it's the establishment who's against it. Back in the day, it was really the business community. The unions were out of power. They did manage to get enough together to hold that last one you referred to in 1937-38. And ever since, actually, the unions have had enough power that now they've been the ones who've wanted to squash it, and they've really been leading the charges against it this time and the last couple as well.
So this time around, 2017, what's the big argument for a constitutional convention in New York, and what's the big argument against?
Well, the big argument for it is really, and the reason it's held, is that there are all these things that our state capital, and frankly most state capitals, don't want to do. The reason it's in the Constitution is because they recognized that legislators and the governor won't always act in the interest of people, and they'll get entrenched. And so once in a while, we're going to throw it open to the people and let them do it. So the issues here are ethics reform, things like term limits, campaign finance, greater disclosure, greater caps on donations, things like that, maybe opening up the voting process. We don't have early voting in New York. It perennially comes up in the legislature, like all these issues do, and they just die on the vine. So those are sort of the wish list on just a few items on the reformist wish list for having a constitutional convention. The people against it say Pandora's box, risky roll of the dice, too many things could happen, anything could happen. Koch brothers, all this. These outside money could come in and sway things and manipulate the whole process.
There have been major ethical scandals, financial scandals, corruption that have rocked Albany, you know, all the way to the top of the state house in New York. It would make some sense that the establishment would say, don't go there.
Oh, absolutely. And it would, by the same token, it would make sense that there might be enough of an uprising. You know, we're kind of giving Springfield, Illinois and Baton Rouge run for the money with the indictments and convictions of our top two legislative leaders in recent years, overturned on a technicality, pending retrial, but there are all kinds of reasons why people might want to take another shot at reforming government because the standard process isn't working. But again, there's enough entrenchment, enough odd sort of bedfellows coalitioning between the far right and the far left and all these people in between, pro-choice, anti-choice, pro-environment. They've all kind of come out against the CONCON because it's just too risky.
Oh, you just went there. You said CONCON, Fred Mogul. Oh, no. Well, before I let you go, though, so low turnout, not a lot of people are going to vote. I think I'm comfortable predicting that. Any sense of where this is going to go? Is it going to happen? Is there going to be a constitutional convention in the state of New York?
Well, the polls would suggest that they're not. They had been leaning for the CONCON, for the Constitutional Convention, and then they kind of switched in the last couple of weeks pretty heavily. So I wouldn't want to put a lot of money on it unless I got very good odds.
Every two-decade ritual in the state of New York. Tomorrow, voters decide whether to open up the state's constitution to amendment. They don't go there often. Will they go there this time? Fred Mogul, WNYC. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. It's Todd Zwillick. Investigations continue into how the suspect in last week's New York City truck attack, Saifullo Saipov, became radicalized in this country. And that makes this week's Retro Report documentary especially relevant. It's all about attempts to deprogram people radicalized by ISIS in the United States and what doomsday cults can teach us about the potential for helping indoctrinated people back into society. Jeffrey O'Connor is a producer at Retro Report, and he says there are some important things for investigators to consider as they look into Saipov's background.
I think the key questions are, was he watching ISIS videos? And it appears he was. Was there a recruiter involved, or was this a case of self-radicalization? But also his background. What are the triggering events that brought him to this act of extremism?
Now, you've looked back at some of the radicalization in the Somali community in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in this week's Retro Report. And a woman named Deka Hussein, who's a leader in the community, but her son, Abdirazak, became radicalized and is in prison now for conspiring to join ISIS with others in his school to join ISIS in Syria. Let's listen to Deka.
My son was brainwashed because he was watching this propaganda video. He thought that if he go to Syria, he's going to go to heaven and all my family is going to go to heaven.
Jeffrey, one of the issues you're talking about is why young men like Abdirazak and his friends are susceptible to radicalization in a place like Minneapolis.
Right. I mean, what we have found over the last 15, 20 years, both in particularly in Europe, but also now in the United States, is that those that are drawn to radicalization are a younger demographic. Between 18 and 30, they're usually on the fringes of society. In Europe, many of them have come out of the prison system, and they don't have a long history of involvement in their own religion. They're often new to the religion. So this radicalization happens extremely fast.
And another point you make in the documentary is that feelings of separation, alienation, or injustice can be very, very important here. This is Daniel Kuhler. He's director of the German Institute on Radicalization and De-Radicalization Studies.
The recruitment handbook of ISIS, I would say, is on a PhD psychology level. The ideology can talk almost exclusively about justice and injustice, about you being the fighter for good, the warrior that defends the poor and helpless against the evil.
I mean, I think what we're facing now is a war of ideas, and those ideas in the hands of ISIS are being manipulated and merged into larger concepts about the end of the world and violence and martyrdom. And all of that is presented by ISIS in a very kind of romantic presentation in the videos themselves. So these young men saw themselves as part of a heroic challenge. They were going to save the world. They were going to be involved in this struggle to save the world. And a lot of that comes out of sentiments in which they feel diminished in their own world, whether for their own psychological reasons or as a result of discrimination in the community or their inability to fit in.
Now, another point that you're making in this film, though, is that while the ISIS phenomenon itself is relatively new, the broader phenomenon is not. ISIS, for all of its other attributes, is a cult. It's far from the first cult in the world and not the first cult of the modern era.
Right. You have to look at what defines an extremist cult or an end times cult, as we call it. And that's essentially that what is the kind of galvanizing thought that's really driving the ideology or the religious interpretation is that we are going towards the end of the world, Armageddon. ISIS is distinct from Al-Qaeda in their religious orientation and their appropriation of this idea of the end of the world, and also that their leader, al-Baghdadi, is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, if you look at cults like Jim Jones, he saw himself or presented himself as the incarnation of God and Vladimir Lenin.
We have to eliminate poverty, racism, injustice, and war. In the meantime, I shall be God, and beside me, there shall be no other.
Yeah.
So what's the lesson then if we've had this experience before on a different level, Jonestown in the early 70s, experience with Al-Qaeda recruitment, now ISIS recruitment in our own backyard in Minnesota? What's the lesson for prevention for somebody like Saipov, comes to this country, can't get a good job, gets upset and alienated, living in pretty rough conditions in Paterson, New Jersey?
Look, as ISIS is losing ground in Syria and Iraq, what is happening is that we are increasingly dealing with a war of ideas. And that what we have to realize is that these are very dangerous concepts that are floating around on the internet. And that people like Saipov and the young men in Minnesota who feel that they can't find a place in this society, or simultaneously they're encountering forces of discrimination, they're going to go out and search for ways to sort of redeem themselves, you know, to find a place in the world, to attach themselves to a larger struggle, even if it means martyrdom. That is the crazy thing here, that we have to recognize that there is a historical pattern of cults, Heaven's Gate, Jonestown, in which people take their lives, and now we're seeing it with religious groups like ISIS.
I mean, there are detention facilities. The justice system in Minnesota now insists that young men like Abdirazak go through essentially de-radicalization, deprogramming training before they can come out.
That's correct. It's a combined effort of intervention and supervision. It's a program that really looks at changing the ideas that motivated the behavior of these young men, engaging them in a conversation that's ongoing, that there are answers to the problems in the world that are not unilateral, that are not a kind of tunnel vision approach. And I should add that this applies to white supremacists and radical extremists. That program is being applied to both groups in Minneapolis.
Understanding the realities of extremist recruitment in America and finding the parallels with doomsday cults of our past. Jeffrey O'Connor, producer for Retro Report, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You can see the latest Retro Report documentary on our website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And more now from our ongoing coverage of the opioid crisis in America. We get a different perspective on the problem now, different than one you may have heard, and one that might be controversial.
The vast majority of people who use heroin are not addicted. Less than 10% of the people who are prescribed these medications become addicted. So the addiction rates are not out of control.
That is Dr. Carl Hart. He's chairman of the psychology department at Columbia University in New York and author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Changes Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Hart disagrees with what many experts have said on this show, that opioid abuse is an addiction crisis. He wrote recently that people aren't dying because of opioids, but because of ignorance. Carl Hart also says America is repeating a misguided track record of punishment for black and brown drug users. I spoke to Carl Hart about how he thinks America should tackle opioid deaths and why he says we've been doing it all wrong.
What happens and what has happened in other sort of drug crises or epidemics is that most of the money goes to law enforcement. And then that sets us up into this sort of frame where we actually now have racial discrimination in our drug law enforcement. this has happened not only in this situation, it's currently happening now, where we know that 80% of the people who are arrested for opioid-related crimes at the federal level are Black or Latino. Now, this isn't new. This has happened since 1914 when we passed our first drug laws. It happened in 1937 when we got crazy about marijuana or cannabis. It happened in the 1960s and 70s in New York State. We passed the Rockefeller drug laws in response to that opioid crisis. 80 to 90% of the people arrested there were Black and brown people. It happened in 1986 when we got crazy about crack cocaine. Same sorts of things happened then that are happening now. And it gives us, or it provides an opportunity for us, to be racist in our drug law enforcement. And that's precisely what happened. And it doesn't solve the problem. That's the major thing.
Now, somebody's going to turn around on the law enforcement side and say, Dr. Hart, wait, things are different now. Congress is serious about criminal justice reform. President Trump proposed a massive expansion in drug courts, right? Judges sending people to treatment, not to jail, for using. Then they might say to you, well, now we view criminal justice differently. That's not going to happen this time.
Yeah. So remember, the vast majority of people who use opioids do not need treatment. And so if you're putting more money into treatment, that's not the most important aspect. And then when we talk about drug courts are a bad idea in part because they don't focus on the behavioral interests. What they care about is that you have a clean urine. Drug court pretends that the behavior of interest is the drug use, and it's not. The behavior of interest is how well people are behaving in our society.
We've had a lot of similarly situated experts like you come on the show and say the problem is addiction. The problem is the strength of these drugs at the synapse in the brain, highly addictive, that gets you hooked. And then all the problems spring from that. Talk to me about what you see as the practical approach, or is your argument that this isn't as big a problem as people think and we should be focused elsewhere?
Whenever someone is talking to you about addiction in the brain, they are intending to distract you because at the moment there is no biological substrate or mechanism that differentiates someone who is addicted versus someone who is not addicted. There is no biological difference or mechanism that we can point to. Number one, now when we think about people being addicted, that's a real concern for me. But we must keep in mind that the vast majority of people who use opioids, whether it's heroin or whether it's OxyContin, are not addicted. So that tells you one thing. It tells you that the problem cannot be the drug itself. Now it helps us to look at, well, what are the problems? We know that the people who are more likely to be addicted are white, male, in rural areas, co-occurring psychiatric illnesses or pain problems. We know these sorts of things. They are unemployed or underemployed, uninsured or underinsured. Those sorts of things help us to guide our treatment.
Okay, so then go from that argument then to what I think is your argument that the better approach to this problem, which is not an epidemic in your view, is to look at the social context and the social construct around inappropriate use of opioids.
Absolutely. When we look at the social context, we think of the person as a holistic person. We're better able to treat drug addiction in general, whether it's the opioids specifically or drug addiction in general. We can look at, for example, arguably the most effective treatment in the United States is methadone. We also have now buprenorphine. All of those two treatments, they are inclusive of the entire person. We make sure that they get the therapy that they need, and we make sure that these other sort of psychosocial issues are dealt with.
Okay, so sometimes when I have people like you, Dr. Hart, on this show, I like to give them a magic wand. And you get to take it to Congress, let's say. You get to do whatever you want and convince them to do it. What's your wish?
If it was up to me, the first thing I would do is separate the issues and make sure we focus on what's important. And the most important issue for me, as we think about this opioid crisis that we're calling it, are the deaths. And one thing that we know is that the majority of these people are dying because they combine opioids with another sedative. And so I would have public service announcements warning the public not to combine opioids with another sedative, one. Another reason that people are dying is because they are using opioids that may be tainted with something like fentanyl or contains only fentanyl, which is a lot more potent than the other opioids, and people are dying as a result. So I would set up free drug purity testing sites that are anonymous, where people could submit samples of their drugs and then get a chemical analysis breakdown of what's in that sample. These sort of anonymous drug purity centers are set up in places like Spain, places like the Netherlands, like Belgium. This has been going on in those places, and they're keeping their citizens safe. Those are the first two things I do. When it comes to drug treatment, I would make sure that people who are using drugs get what they need in supervised or monitored facilities, just like they do in places like Switzerland. But I would make sure that they also have adjunctive therapies like social workers, like psychologists, and all of those sorts of things. So that means that we might actually have to administer heroin to people who are addicted to heroin. The goal is to keep people safe, number one, productive, and happy.
Boy, I'm glad you have a magic wand, Dr. Hart, because I'm a senator and no bill that I'm going to vote for is going to encourage and enable the use of dangerous drugs like heroin.
Well, I have to call that like it is. I'd be like, you are ignorant when you say things like dangerous drug like heroin, when in fact, heroin is essentially the same drug as morphine. And we give morphine to folks who are in chronic pain. And heroin is an approved medication in parts of Europe. And so I think that's precisely the problem. We have a number of ignorant people in control of our policy in the United States. And it is driving many of us who are not ignorant bonkers.
Dr. Carl L. Hart, chairman of psychology at Columbia University, also author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Thanks for the challenge, Dr. Hart.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
My name is Liz Ritter. I lived in Washington Heights in the 80s and the 90s. And at that time, for the most part, black and brown people were given long prison sentences for using crack cocaine. But white boys on Wall Street were getting off with a slap on the wrist if they even got that.
My name is Don. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. The crack epidemic was much more stringent, much more severe, because it was black people that were mostly involved. Now you got a whole lot of white people abusing opioids, so it's no big deal. It's another example of racism.
Your views on drugs in America. You can call us 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.